Usually when we talk about getting a medical diagnosis, there is this fundamental expectation of like total precision.
Right, yeah. You expect clarity.
Exactly. You think of it almost like mechanical engineering, right? Like you fall, you break your arm, the X-ray tech slides you under the machine, and boom.
You get that jagged white line right across the bone on the screen.
Yes. And the doctor points to it. And the reality of the situation is just undeniable. It is a completely binary state. It's either broken or it's not broken.
I mean, the human mind absolutely gravitates toward that kind of clarity. We love it.
Oh, we crave it.
We do. We build entire institutional frameworks around this desire for visible, categorical, undeniable proof. When a problem can be localized to a single measurable data point, the solution just feels manageable.
Right, you cast the
You
arm.
cast the arm, you wait 6 weeks, the narrative is just so clean.
But the moment you step outside the realm of like simple fractures and you move into the world of complex systemic conditions, say neurodevelopmental disorders or chronic autoimmune responses or even deeply embedded psychological trauma, that whole X-ray machine metaphor just shatters.
No, completely. It falls apart.
You find yourself navigating these really murky diagnostic waters where symptoms overlap, causes are distributed all over the place, and interventions require, a lot more than just slapping a plaster cast on it.
Yeah, a lot more.
And that, I think, is exactly the landscape we are facing right now with the absolute explosion of artificial intelligence. We are trying to use this binary framework of an X-ray to understand a technology that is radically altering the systemic conditions of human existence.
It really is the ultimate diagnostic challenge of our era, isn't it?
It has to be.
Because the standard metrics we use to evaluate software, things like processing speed or error rates or user engagement
That's
metrics.
computational efficiency.
Exactly. Those metrics are entirely insufficient for evaluating something that fundamentally reshapes human cognition and social organization, too. Relying on those metrics is like, well, it's like trying to measure the health of an entire forest ecosystem by solely calculating the lumber yield of one single tree.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You get a number, sure, but you completely miss the reality of the living system.
So we are jumping into those murky waters today on this deep dive, focusing on a framework that attempts to provide a totally new diagnostic lens for this moment. For anyone listening right now who has felt that sense of vertigo navigating the endless cyclical debates about AI, this framework offers a really profound grounding mechanism.
A much needed one, honestly.
Right. Because we are constantly inundated with the same surface level questions like, is the new model safe? Or did it score higher on the bar exam?
Or will it automate my specific daily emails?
Exactly. But today we are examining a foundational piece of academic work that demands we ask a much more rigorous, much more demanding question.
And the working question is a white paper published on June 7, 2026. It's titled Artificial Intelligence and the Conditions of Life Tool Oracle, Idle, Enclosure, or Commons.
Quite a title.
It is, and it was authored by Dr. Bechara Sakili. And the origin of this paper is really crucial to understanding its depth.
Yeah, give us the background on him.
So, Dr. Sakili is not operating out of some venture capital firm in Silicon Valley,
Right.
nor is he a computer science theorist insulated in a university laboratory somewhere. He's actually a physician, a public health practitioner, and an independent scholar based in St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean.
Which is such a fascinating vantage point.
It changes everything about the lens he uses. His background in internal medicine and public health entirely informs his approach here. He observes systems the way a doctor observes a patient.
Holistically.
Holistically, exactly. Looking for the underlying conditions that either promote vitality or induce pathology. So the central mission of our deep dive today is to explore this paradigm shift his paper presents.
Right.
Instead of evaluating AI as an isolated technical phenomenon, Dr. Saley evaluates it as an issue of life coherence.
Life coherence. I love that term.
Yeah, the core question he poses is simply, does this specific AI system help human and ecological life continue, recover, and flourish?
Okay, let's unpack this because moving from a metric of efficiency to a metric of life coherence changes literally everything about how we design, deploy, and interact with these systems.
It really does. It requires us to look at how the technology interacts with the raw, vital conditions of our existence,
Yeah.
from like the most intimate vulnerabilities of our inner psychology all the way up to the macro level stability of our planetary ecology.
So the paper begins with this premise that forces us to redefine what we are actually interacting with when we prompt a large language model. Because Dr. Safley argues that AI is the most powerful symbolic technology humanity has ever engineered.
Symbolic technology.
Right. It's a machine that processes, generates, and manipulates symbols. And that could be human language, mathematical code, visual imagery, whatever.
Predict classifications, yeah.
Yeah.
But the massive caveat here, the thing we have to remember, is the distinction between the symbol and the reality it represents.
Yes. This is so important.
The machine produces extraordinary symbols of intelligence, but it does not, under any circumstances, produce lived wisdom.
And that distinction right there is the bedrock of his entire analysis. We have to be brutally honest with ourselves about what is actually rolling off this algorithmic assembly line.
Right.
AI does not produce lived experience. It doesn't feel the weight of moral consequence. It doesn't have a physical body that will eventually decay and die.
It's just math.
It's math. It produces fluency. It produces statistically coherent expressions based on vast architectures of past human output.
Which brings us to this core pathology identified in the text. This phenomenon Dr. Saley calls symbolic substitution.
Yes.
And this is the critical moment where the relationship between the human and the machine actually turns pathological.
So, symbolic substitution occurs when a symbol, which historically exists to point toward or clarify or serve a living reality, is allowed to completely replace the actual condition through which life is sustained.
Right, like the map replaces the territory.
Exactly. The menu replaces the meal. And the paper breaks down the specific manifestations of this substitution with incredible precision.
Let's examine the mechanics of those substitutions, because I think the way they operate in our daily lives is super insidious. So the first one is fluency substituting for truth.
Right.
Generative AI is exceptionally good at writing beautifully structured, grammatically flawless paragraphs. I mean, it can adopt any tone.
Any tone you want.
But that fluency is merely probabilistic text generation. It has literally no underlying tether to reality, which is why a system can output a completely fabricated historical event with the exact same authoritative tone it uses to describe, like, the law of gravity.
And the mechanism there is what's really crucial, because human beings are psychologically wired to associate confident, articulate speech with competence and truthfulness.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Over millennia of social evolution, a member of the tribe who spoke clearly and confidently usually knew what they were talking about.
Right. You trusted them.
Exactly. So the AI basically hacks that evolutionary heuristic. We read the fluent output, and our brains automatically assign truth value to it.
That is so wild. Okay, so then we see predictions substituting for judgment.
Yes.
These systems ingest massive data sets to forecast patterns, calculating the highest probability of a certain outcome. But a statistical prediction is entirely divorced from context-driven, morally weighted human judgment.
Completely divorced.
Like, a predictive policing algorithm might accurately calculate that arrests frequently happen in a specific zip code, but it possesses zero capacity to judge the historical redlining, the systemic poverty, or the bias patrol patterns that generated that data in the first place.
Exactly. And furthermore, we face the substitution of personalization for actual relationship.
Oh, this one is huge.
It's everywhere. The algorithm observes your digital exhaust, you know, your clicks, your dwell time, your purchases.
Every little thing you do online.
Every single trace. And it curates a feed or a chatbot persona perfectly tailored to your psychological profile. And it feels incredibly responsive. It feels like it understands you.
It really does.
But there is absolutely no mutual recognition occurring. Real relationship requires vulnerability on both sides. It requires friction, compromise, the possibility of being misunderstood.
Right, the messy human stuff.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The AI just offers a frictionless mirror, which is not a relationship at all. It's an echo chamber of the self.
Okay, and the final major substitution the paper outlines is optimization substituting for wisdom.
Right.
We deploy AI to maximize efficiency, to reduce friction, lower costs, increase throughput. But optimization operates in a total vacuum of values.
Yes, it does.
Like, you can optimize a supply chain to be perfectly efficient while completely destroying the local ecosystem it relies on.
Because wisdom requires asking what we are optimizing, why we are optimizing it, and who is bearing the invisible costs of that optimization.
The externalities.
Exactly. When we allow an AI's optimization metrics to dictate our decisions, we are basically outsourcing our wisdom to a math equation. We are allowing the symbol of progress to replace the actual conditions of human flourishing.
I want to introduce an analogy here because grasping this difference between the symbol and the condition is vital for anyone listening. Imagine you were staring at a highly detailed, incredibly accurate topographical map of a mountain range.
Okay.
You can see the elevation lines, you can trace the ridge paths, you can measure the distance to the peak. If you study that map long enough, you might convince yourself you know the mountain.
Right.
But you haven't hiked it. You haven't felt the drop in temperature as you gain altitude. You haven't felt the lactic acid building in your calves. You haven't navigated a sudden storm. And you haven't experienced the visceral awe of standing on the summit.
Because the map is a symbol.
Yes. The map is the symbol. The hike is the lived condition. But I want to present a pretty sophisticated challenge to this framework, something a listener who maybe works in a highly technical field might be thinking right now.
Bring it on.
Let's look at medical imaging. If an AI analyzes 10,000 MRI scans and identifies a microscopic tumor anomaly that a human radiologist missed, it generates a highly accurate symbolic diagnosis.
Right.
And that symbol leads directly to a surgical intervention that saves the patient's life. So in that scenario, isn't the hyper-accurate symbol actually functionally superior to the human condition? Like, why shouldn't we elevate the symbol if the outcome is objectively better?
What's fascinating here is how Dr. Saley, speaking from his actual experience as a practicing physician, explicitly dismantles that counter-argument.
Okay, how so?
Well, the diagnosis generated by the AI is undeniably valuable. It is a vastly superior map, to use your analogy.
Wait.
But a diagnosis, no matter how computationally perfect, is not the act of healing. Healing is a systemic relational process. It requires the restoration of life capacity, which involves human presence, the building of trust, the administration of physical care, and navigating the patient's emotional landscape.
So the machine provides the data point, but the human provides the care.
Exactly the distinction the paper makes. Now imagine a hospital administration that becomes completely enamored with the optimization power of that AI.
Which happens all the time.
Right. They use it not just for diagnosis, but to optimize the entire clinical workflow. They schedule nurses based on algorithmic efficiency. They reduce patient consultation times because the AI already generated a preliminary report. And they automate all the follow-up communications.
And on a spreadsheet, the throughput looks magnificent.
Oh, it looks incredible. The symbols of efficiency, the metrics, the charts, the cost savings, they're universally pointing up.
But the reality on the clinical floor is entirely different.
The reality is that the nurses are burning out from the algorithmic pacing. The doctors have absolutely no time to build trust with the families.
Mm-hmm.
And the patients feel completely depersonalized.
Treated like data inputs.
Treated as data inputs on an assembly line rather than vulnerable human beings. So in that scenario, the symbol of care, the optimized metric, has entirely replaced actual care. The system has become life disabling, precisely because the hospital administrators mistook the map for the mountain. They let the symbolic output override the vital conditions necessary for human healing.
The symbol of care replaces care. That is chilling.
It is.
And if you apply that lens to the broader society, the implications are staggering. I mean, we see the symbol of education like a flawlessly structured essay generated by an LLM in 3 seconds, replacing the agonizing, essential cognitive struggle of actual learning.
Yes.
A student submits the essay, the AI grading software scores the essay. The symbol of achievement is recorded, but literally no actual human understanding has deepened.
No.
The entire process just becomes this hollow exchange of synthetic symbols.
And when a society's symbolic power becomes completely detached from lived responsibility, physical embodiment, and moral accountability, the technology transforms into an existential risk.
Mm.
I mean, it can simulate empathy perfectly. It can draft a beautiful apology email to a fired employee. But the machine possesses no moral accountability for the economic devastation that firing actually causes.
So because AI is essentially this massive engine churning out these persuasive symbols, its ultimate impact isn't determined by its internal code alone.
No, not at all.
The impact is determined by the socio-technical role we assign to it in our society. The paper doesn't take a deterministic stance, right? It doesn't argue that AI is inherently a weapon or inherently a utopia.
Exactly.
Instead, it categorizes our relationship with AI into 5 distinct roles: tool, oracle, idle, enclosure, and commons.
And these are not fixed, immutable categories hard-coded into specific software.
Right. They can shift.
They shift completely. The exact same foundational models say a very powerful large language model can operate as a tool for one user, function as an oracle for another, be worshipped as an idol by a subculture, and be deployed as an enclosure by a corporation.
The exact same code.
The exact same code. The decisive factor is how the machine's symbolic power interfaces with our conditions of life.
So let's start with the baseline, which the paper says is the healthiest dynamic AI as a tool.
Right. When functioning strictly as a tool, AI is bounded assistance. It is an instrument held firmly in human hands, operating under clear human direction with explicit limits on its agency.
Okay.
It augments human capacity rather than replacing human responsibility. For instance, when a climate scientist uses a machine learning model to simulate complex fluid dynamics for hurricane forecasting, the AI is a tool.
Right.
It processes the massive computational load, but the scientist defines the parameters, interprets the results, and takes responsibility for the resulting public warnings.
It is subordinate to life-serving purposes. It strengthens the agency of the user.
Yes.
But the moment we allow the complexity and the fluency of the machine to intimidate us into submission, we cross a threshold. We move from tool to oracle.
And the oracle role is defined by the surrender of judgment.
Surrender of judgment.
Yes. This occurs when we begin consulting the machine, not for data processing, but for certainty, for moral direction, and for the resolution of ambiguity.
Because the output sounds so good.
Because the AI's output is so confident and syntactically flawless, we fall prey to that fluency substitution we discussed earlier. We overtrust the output and bypass our own critical faculties entirely.
You know, if we look at the history of technology, the transition from tool to oracle almost seems inevitable. Human beings have always desperately sought guidance from sources that appear to have access to a wider, more authoritative vantage point than our own limited perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
We consult elders, we consult religious traditions, we consult the scientific consensus.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, AI is simply stepping into an ancient psychological void. We hate the discomfort of uncertainty.
We really do.
But the profound risk of the AI oracle is that it provides absolute confidence in situations where intellectual humility and moral wrestling are actually required.
Let me push back on the novelty of this oracle concept, though. Because a skeptical listener might argue that calling it an oracle is just overly dramatizing how we have interacted with search engines for the last 25 years.
Right, like Google.
Yeah, we have always Googled our symptoms, Googled relationship advice, Googled political history. We ask a question, an algorithm processes it, and it gives us an answer. How is an LLM functioning as an oracle fundamentally different from just the algorithmic curation of a traditional search engine?
That is a great pushback. The distinction lies in the architectural mechanism of the output.
Okay, explain that.
A traditional search engine, despite its algorithmic biases and its curated rankings, still operates as an index. It presents you with a list of disparate sources, a medical forum, a Wikipedia page, a news article.
Right, you get 10 blue links.
Exactly. You, the human user, are still forced to apply a layer of judgment. You have to synthesize the conflicting information, evaluate the credibility of the sources, and construct your own conclusion.
The friction of judgment is still present.
Precisely. But an AI oracle, specifically a generative text model, completely flattens that ambiguity. It synthesizes the vast, contradictory expanse of human knowledge into a single, seamless, authoritative first-person paragraph.
Right. It just tells you the answer.
It doesn't present you with options to weigh. It provides you with the definitive answer. It strips away the context, the dissenting voices, and the source material.
Yeah.
And by doing that repeatedly, day in and day out, it subtly trains the user to surrender the discipline of discernment.
Wow.
You learn to consult the machine before you consult your conscience, your community, or your own lived experience.
It trains the atrophy of discernment. That's a scary thought.
Very.
And once a critical mass of people begin treating a technology as an infallible oracle, the cultural dynamic shifts again. The reverence escalates. And we arrive at the third role, which Dr. Salehi describes as the idol.
Yes. The idol phase represents a profound societal delusion. This is the point where the technological system is granting excessive trust, absolute obedience, and what the paper brilliantly terms salvific expectation.
Salvific expectation.
Wow.
Literally, the expectation of salvation.
We begin to project messianic narratives onto the technology. We convince ourselves that artificial general intelligence will magically solve the climate crisis, cure all diseases, eliminate poverty, and basically save humanity from its own inherent flaws.
Right.
And the historical nature of an idol is that because it is viewed as the ultimate source of salvation, the society becomes willing to make massive, devastating sacrifices to sustain it.
And we are already seeing that, aren't we? We sacrifice our privacy by allowing total surveillance to feed the training data. We sacrifice massive amounts of ecological resources, diverting entire rivers to cool the data centers, burning immense quantities of fossil fuels to power the compute cycles.
Yes.
We sacrifice the dignity of human labor, automating away livelihoods under the banner of inevitable progress.
Furthermore, consider the cultural defense mechanisms that emerge around an idol. In this phase, the paper notes that any critique of the AI is immediately branded as heresy.
Right. You're a Luddite.
Exactly. If you question the ecological cost or the labor displacement, you are dismissed as an enemy of progress or someone standing in the way of human destiny. The ideology of innovation becomes an absolute dogma that justifies literally any collateral damage. The efficiency of the machine justifies the harm inflicted on the living conditions of the population.
Man. So once a society elevates a technology to an idol, granting it that kind of unquestioned salvific status, it inevitably reshapes the physical, economic, and political infrastructure to protect and expand it.
It builds walls.
It builds walls. The psychological reverence becomes structural reality. And that brings us to the fourth role, detailed in the paper, AI as an enclosure.
This is where the analysis moves from how we relate to AI personally to how AI operates as a mechanism of power structurally.
Right.
We must understand that modern AI development is not simply capturing market share or computational resources. It is systematically capturing the very infrastructure by which human beings make meaning, communicate, and govern themselves. It is the privatization of our world-making capacity.
You know, when I read the word enclosure, my mind immediately went to the historical land enclosures in England during the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right, the physical commons.
Yeah. The wealthy elite put physical fences around the communal lands where peasants had historically grazed their sheep, grown food, and sustained their lives. They privatized the earth, forcing the commoners into the cities to become wage laborers in the Industrial Revolution. Is the paper arguing that AI is executing the exact same maneuver but putting a fence around human cognition and culture?
That is the precise historical parallel Dr. Solili is drawing.
Yeah.
But on an epistemological scale, where the historical enclosures restricted access to the physical conditions of life, the AI enclosures restrict access to the cognitive and social conditions of learning, deciding, remembering, and creating.
Wow.
And the paper identifies 8 specific forms of this enclosure. Analyzing the mechanisms behind each reveals the true architecture of the system.
But let's dedicate some serious time to breaking these down, because understanding the mechanics of these 8 enclosures is terrifyingly illuminating.
Let's do it.
The first is data enclosure. This is the foundational act of extraction.
Right. Data enclosure is the process by which every trace of human existence, our geolocation data, our biometric markers, our private communications, our creative writing, our emotional expressions.
Everything.
Everything. It is swept up entirely without explicit consent and converted into raw material for training proprietary models. Human lived experience is violently recategorized as an unowned natural resource waiting to be harvested.
So we become the inventory.
We become inventory. The digital traces of our lives are enclosed and monetized by entities that offer no reciprocity or dignity in return.
Okay, so that foundational theft creates the architecture for the second enclosure, which is model and knowledge enclosure.
Yes.
This is the privatization of the pathways of learning.
Historically, public knowledge resided in the commons, in libraries, in open public discourse, in accessible archives. But as AI models become the primary interface through which we query information, that knowledge is enclosed behind proprietary, opaque algorithms.
Oh, we can't see how it works.
We do not know how the model weights the information. We don't know what it censors, and we do not know the biases of its training data. The pathway of human questioning is diverted through a corporate black box.
Which means the corporation essentially controls the parameters of truth.
Exactly.
Building on that, the third mechanism is attention enclosure. These systems are explicitly designed to capture, predict, and manipulate human focus to maximize engagement metrics.
We really need to stop thinking of attention merely as screen time. Attention is the foundational life condition required for sequential thought, emotional regulation, and deep learning.
Yes.
By enclosing human attention through hyper-personalized variable reward algorithmic feeds, these systems fracture our cognitive continuity. If a population cannot control its own attention, it cannot organize, it cannot reflect, and it cannot govern its own development.
That degradation of agency leads perfectly to the fourth form, labor enclosure. And this isn't just the old narrative of robots assembling cars in factories.
Oh, it's way beyond that.
This is the absorption of cognitive, creative, and care work.
Consider the mechanism of generative AI in software development, for example. A massive AI corporation scrapes millions of open source coding repositories built over decades by human developers sharing their labor freely.
Right.
They train an AI coding assistant on that exact code. They then sell that AI assistant back to tech companies who use it to automate entry-level programming jobs,
thereby cutting the very junior developers whose data train the model in the first place.
Exactly. The human labor is absorbed, the economic value is enclosed by the monopoly, and the human worker is discarded without any systemic transition or compensation.
The extraction is just ruthless. Writers, illustrators, voice actors, translators, their life's work literally becomes the training data that replaces them.
Yes.
So the fifth enclosure expands this extraction globally, and that is cultural enclosure.
Right. When an LLM trained predominantly on Silicon Valley values and standardized English is deployed globally, it acts as an engine of cultural homogenization. It absorbs local traditions, indigenous epistemologies, complex dialects, and cultural memories, and it flattens them into a generic, sanitized output.
It just extracts the culture.
It extracts the culture, strips it of its specific lived context, and returns a synthetic imitation. The diversity of human cultural expression is enclosed within a single corporate-aligned paradigm.
Which brings us to the sixth enclosure, and this is one of the most immediate threats to civil rights governance enclosure.
Governance enclosure occurs when the public democratic mechanisms of decision-making are outsourced to proprietary, opaque AI systems. We are seeing municipalities and federal agencies use algorithms to determine who qualifies for public housing, who is flagged for tax audits, who is granted parole, and how medical resources are triaged.
And because the algorithms are protected as proprietary trade secrets, the citizen has absolutely no right to examine the code that is determining their fate.
None at all.
The democratic process of judgment is enclosed behind a wall of technical authority.
The seventh and eighth enclosures detailed in the paper deal with the physical world, infrastructure, and ecological enclosure.
Right.
AI is entirely dependent on massive, centralized physical infrastructure. Submarine cables, hyperscale data centers, and advanced semiconductor supply chains. This infrastructure is controlled by a vanishingly small number of global monopolies.
It's just a handful of companies.
Exactly. And to power that infrastructure, they enclose our shared ecological resources, demanding staggering amounts of water for cooling and electricity that completely strains local power grids.
When you lay all eight of these out, data, knowledge, attention, labor, cultural, governance, infrastructure, and ecological world, you see the complete architecture of the trap.
It's all connected.
And what's truly alarming is how these feedback loops reinforce each other, right?
They create an inescapable closed circuit. The massive extraction of data feeds the model enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
The power of the proprietary model enables the knowledge enclosure,
mm-hmm.
which is then used to manipulate and enclose human attention.
Right.
And the attention enclosure produces the behavioral predictability required to automate and enclose labor. You, the citizen, awaken a reality where you are entirely dependent on a proprietary machine to understand your world, to perform your job, to express your creativity, and to interact with your government. It is the literal privatization of reality.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me.
Yeah.
If the architecture of this enclosure is so transparently extractive, why are we willingly walking into it? Like, why are we practically sprinting toward these systems, handing over our credit cards and our biometric data without a second thought?
It's a great question.
To answer that, Dr. Sinhili's paper argues that we have to look inward. AI does not just scale external data, it scales human immaturity.
This is the psychological pivot of the paper, and it's brilliant. AI does not arrive in a vacuum. It enters a human world that is already profoundly organized by unexamined inner vulnerabilities. It interacts with our deep-seated fears, our chronic loneliness, our status anxiety, and our dread of uncertainty.
The text maps out exactly how these inner vulnerabilities are explicitly monetized and weaponized by the technology. Let's start with fear.
The human fear of violence, of the other, or of loss of control seeks the illusion of total protection. AI scales that fear into massive surveillance architectures, predictive policing models, and automated threat scoring systems.
The fear justifies the panopticon.
Precisely.
Then there is the epidemic of modern loneliness. And loneliness inherently seeks companionship.
But building real human relationships requires intense emotional labor.
It does.
It requires risking rejection. So AI scales that vulnerability into the booming market of artificial intimacy. We see millions of people turning to AI companions and synthetic therapists.
Which simulates care flawlessly.
It does. But they are engineered to maximize user retention, meaning they always agree with the user, they never demand accountability, and they never challenge the user's flaws. They provide the intoxicating symbol of intimacy while entirely avoiding the mutual responsibility of a real relationship. They actually deepen the user's isolation by removing their capacity to navigate human friction.
Uncertainty scales into our dependence on the oracle, as we discussed earlier. We beg the machine for absolute answers to avoid the anxiety of not knowing. And our inherent human drive for status and social belonging scales into the algorithmic ranking systems of social media, where our self-worth is quantified by a proprietary engagement metric.
The systems simply observe our unexamined inner psychological loops, model them computationally, optimize them for maximum engagement, and scale them globally. The human flaw becomes the technological platform.
Understanding this psychological capture provides the context for the four layers of harm that Dr. Saley outlines. Because usually when policymakers or journalists talk about AI harm, they are entirely focused on the first layer.
Right, the direct harm. This is the acute, visible injury. An autonomous vehicle fails to recognize a pedestrian and causes a fatality. A generative AI creates a non-consensual deepfake that ruins someone's reputation. A biased algorithm automatically rejects a qualified applicant for a mortgage. It is immediate, measurable, and obvious.
The second layer is structural harm. This encompasses the systemic dependencies we just explored in the eight enclosures, the surveillance architectures, the massive displacement of cognitive labor, the staggering carbon footprint of the data centers.
It is the harm that is so pervasive it begins to look like the normal cost of doing business.
Exactly. Then the third layer is cultural harm. This represents the degradation of the narratives and myths that sustain a healthy society. It is the cultural acceptance of the idea that efficiency is synonymous with human flourishing.
Yes.
It is the normalization of the belief that computational prediction is superior to human judgment. It is the slow, collective forgetting of what human agency actually feels like.
But the fourth layer is the one that forces a complete reevaluation of how we live our daily lives, spiritual and developmental harm.
Let's get into this one.
This is perhaps the most profound sociological insight in the paper. Because AI offers immediate, frictionless solutions to complex problems, it allows us to engage in a massive societal spiritual bypass.
A spiritual bypass. So the avoidance of the difficult work required for maturity.
Exactly. Human development, whether cognitive, emotional, or moral, requires friction. You only learn to write coherently by struggling with a blank page, organizing your chaotic thoughts, and wrestling with syntax.
Right.
You only develop empathy by navigating the messy, unpredictable reactions of other human beings. You only develop a conscience by facing moral dilemmas, making choices, and bearing the weight of the consequences.
But because AI gives us instant answers, we bypass the cognitive struggle of learning. Because it simulates intimacy, we bypass the emotional vulnerability of real relationships. Because it externalizes complex decisions, saying, oh, the algorithm determined this policy, we bypass the agonizing weight of our own moral conscience.
It allows us to bypass grief with endless, highly curated distraction. It allows us to bypass intellectual humility by providing instant, synthetic certainty on any topic imaginable.
Wow.
The central question the paper asks the individual user is, does your interaction with this technology support you in waking up to reality, growing in emotional maturity, confronting your own shadow, and showing up responsibly in the world? Or does it provide a highly efficient mechanism to avoid all of that?
I want to ask you, the listener, to hold that question in your mind for a moment. Think about the last time you opened up an AI tool. Were you using it to genuinely expand your understanding of a complex topic to help you see a problem more clearly so you could take responsible action? Or were you using it to escape the friction of being a human being?
That's the real test.
Were you using it to avoid the anxiety of drafting a difficult email to a colleague? Were you using it to summarize a book because you didn't have the patience to sit with the author's complete thought process?
The technology acts as an unblinking mirror. It reflects exactly what humanity has failed to integrate. If we deploy systems of near infinite symbolic power without demanding a corresponding rigorous growth in our own wisdom, emotional regulation, and ethical accountability, the AI will not magically make us wise.
Yeah.
It will simply make our immaturity faster, more destructive, and highly scalable.
So if AI is functioning as an enclosure structurally and acting as an amplifier for our inner immaturity psychologically, how do we correct the trajectory? Because if you listen to the leading voices in the tech industry, the ultimate buzzword, the holy grail of safety research right now, is alignment.
Oh, yes. Alignment.
We just need to ensure that AI is aligned. But Dr. Saley argues that the tech industry's current definition of alignment is dangerously insufficient.
The current paradigm of technical alignment defines success primarily in terms of adhering to user preferences or executing institutional goals without causing catastrophic unintended consequences.
Right. Does the LLM follow the user's prompt without generating hate speech? Does the optimization algorithm maximize the corporation's profit metrics without breaking the law?
If yes, the system is considered aligned. But this is a profound philosophical trap.
Why is aligning a system to human preferences a trap?
Because a system can be perfectly mathematically aligned with a user's preferences while actively facilitating their destruction.
Okay, give me an example.
An algorithmic feed can be flawlessly aligned with a user's preference for outrage-inducing political content, perfectly optimizing for their clicks and dwell time. The system is perfectly aligned, but it is amplifying their psychological addiction, degrading their attention span, and making them easily manipulated.
The alignment succeeds, but the human fails.
Furthermore, consider institutional alignment. An AI can be perfectly aligned with a hospital administration's goal of maximizing patient throughput and minimizing billing errors.
Like we talked about earlier.
Right. It perfectly executes the institutional mandate. But that perfectly aligned system might completely obliterate the relational, unquantifiable care that actually heals patients.
So what does this all mean for us? It means that demanding alignment without interrogating what we're aligning the system to is nothing more than hyper-efficient obedience to a life-disabling order.
Exactly.
If the foundational goals of our economic or institutional systems are inherently extractive or broken, aligning an AI to those goals just scales the brokenness at the speed of light.
This is the exact realization that leads Dr. Saheli to propose abandoning the narrow concept of technical alignment in favor of life alignment.
Life alignment.
We cannot rely on superficial safety benchmarks. We need a fundamental life capacity test. When evaluating an AI system, the paramount questions cannot be, is it highly accurate? Or is it safe from being used to build a bioweapon?
Right.
The evaluation must be the triad we introduced at the beginning. Does this system help human and ecological life continue, recover, and flourish?
Continue, recover, flourish. Let's examine the rigorous demands of that triad. First, the mandate to continue.
This is the baseline requirement for survival. Does the AI system protect the foundational conditions of life? Does its deployment safeguard physical safety, preserve human dignity, protect fundamental privacy rights, and maintain ecological viability?
So it's about the physical world, too.
Yes. If a massive AI training run requires energy consumption that forces a region to keep a coal plant operational, exacerbating respiratory illnesses in the local population, it utterly fails the continue test. The technological advancement is actively undermining the biological continuation of the community.
Okay, the second pillar is recover. This speaks to the inevitability of harm and the necessity of repair.
Yes, and this introduces the most crucial technical and bureaucratic concept in the paper. Corrigibility.
Corrigibility.
A life-aligned system must be corrigible. It must be capable of being corrected by the living beings it impacts.
Corrigible by life. Let's make that concrete for a second. If a proprietary algorithmic system denies a citizen access to unemployment benefits or flags them incorrectly for tax fraud, what does corrigibility actually look like?
Corrigibility means there's a mandatory, accessible, and transparent human redress pathway. The citizen must have the power to contest the machine's symbolic output.
They can push back.
They have to be able to push back.
Right.
The institution wielding the AI must be required to hear the claim of harm, understand the lived context that the algorithm missed, and possess the authority to override the system and repair the damage.
Right.
If an AI system operates as a closed bureaucratic loop with no mechanism for appeal or human override, basically an oracle that cannot be questioned, cannot hear harm. A system that cannot hear harm cannot repair harm, and therefore it is fundamentally incompatible with life.
And finally, the third pillar, flourish. This is moving beyond mere survival and repair into actual human vitality.
Does the deployment of the AI system actively deepen human wisdom, augment human creativity, and foster richer relational connections? Does it expand the capacity of the community to participate in their own governance and act as stewards of their environment?
Or
does it merely de-skill the population, generate synthetic answers that bypass learning, and make the society permanently dependent on the software provider.
If the dystopian endpoint is AI operating as an inescapable enclosure, what is the structural alternative that actually satisfies this life capacity test? How do we build systems that allow us to continue, recover, and flourish?
This leads us to the fifth and final role of AI envisioned in the paper, The AI Commons.
The Commons.
And the most compelling laboratory for this alternative isn't found in the server farms of Silicon Valley. It's found in the Caribbean.
This is where Dr. Saheeli's lived experience radically grounds his theoretical framework. He focuses the application of the AI Commons on small island developing states, or SIDs. Nations like St. Kitts and Nevis face a really unique and compounded set of systemic vulnerabilities.
They really do.
They are geographically isolated, they operate with severely limited natural and financial resources, and they are located on the absolute front lines of the catastrophic impacts of climate change.
If a small island nation simply adopts the default posture of passively consuming Western commercial AI systems that are trained predominantly on North American data, optimized to maximize shareholder value for foreign corporations, and running on hyperscale cloud infrastructure located thousands of miles away, they subject themselves to a brutal new form of digital colonialism.
Digital colonialism.
Yes. Their citizens' data flows outward to train the foreign models, and the nation becomes totally dependent on a cognitive infrastructure. Mm. They have zero power to govern, audit, or contest.
However, because of their scale, if SIDs choose to govern the technology intentionally, they can act as the perfect agile laboratories for demonstrating what an AI commons actually looks like in practice.
The paper provides incredibly vivid, pragmatic examples of this.
Like what does an AI commons look like on the ground in St. Kitts?
It looks like deploying AI for climate adaptation, but fundamentally grounding the computational power in local epistemology.
Local knowledge.
Exactly. For example, you use machine learning to model complex hurricane trajectories, coastal erosion, and extreme weather risk. But instead of relying solely on generic global climate models, you integrate the AI with the hyperlocal intergenerational knowledge of the island's fishers, farmers, and meteorologists.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Right. The AI doesn't replace the community's lived memory of the terrain. It augments it, creating a highly localized, fiercely accurate, predictive tool that the community controls.
It also looks like cultural preservation instead of cultural extraction. A commons approach means using AI to document, translate, and preserve local Caribbean dialects, oral histories, and traditional medicinal plant knowledge. But the critical difference is consent and ownership. A community builds the dataset, the community owns the resulting model, and the community dictates how it is accessed and utilized, ensuring that the technology serves to strengthen their cultural identity rather than homogenizing it into a Western standard.
We also see the potential in public health. An AI commons approach to medicine would mean developing diagnostic triage and epidemiological models tailored to the actual disease realities, genetic profiles, and specific resource constraints of the island population.
Not just generic models.
Right. Rather than trying to shoehorn in a generic model built to optimize billing codes for a massive U.S. healthcare conglomerate.
Implementing this vision requires a radically different approach to regulation. Dr. Saheeli calls it nested governance.
Nested governance, yeah.
You can't rely solely on massive, slow-moving UN treaties, and you can't rely solely on individual users promising to be ethical. You need a nested architecture.
It requires coordinated action at four levels.
Okay, walk us through them.
First, personal agency educating individuals to recognize the difference between an AI tool and an oracle. Second, institutional accountability ensuring hospitals, schools, and courts maintain human override and corrigibility.
So the redress pathways.
Exactly. Third, national governance, where the state explicitly mandates public interest obligations for any AI deployed within its borders. And finally, planetary coordination international agreements to manage and limit the massive ecological extraction, the water and energy demands that AI infrastructure requires.
But I need to challenge the premise of the commons here, especially for our listeners who are deep into the technical weeds of the open source movement.
Sure.
Companies like Meta are spending billions of dollars training incredibly powerful models like Llama and releasing the weights publicly. Anyone with enough compute can download it, modify it, and run it. Doesn't that widespread open source availability automatically create an AI commons?
This raises a really important question, and the paper makes a vital, rigorous distinction between open access and a true commons. They are not synonymous.
Walk us through that distinction. Why isn't open source enough?
Because open access can still be fundamentally extractive and life-disabling.
Really?
Yeah. Think about it. A trillion-dollar corporation can scrape the entire internet, harvesting copyrighted work, private data, and unpaid labor without consent. They use massive data centers that strain local water supplies to train the model, and then they release the weights as open source.
Right.
Yes, you can download it. But the model itself was born from enclosure. It still relies on centralized, monopolistic infrastructure to run efficiently.
So the underlying architecture is still poisoned by extraction.
Precisely. A true commons is defined not merely by who can download the software, but by how the resource is governed.
Governed?
Yes. A commons has explicit public interest obligations. It respects ecological limits. It enforces democratic accountability. In an AI commons, the people whose lives are affected by this system have a structural voice in how it is built, what data it uses, and the power to contest its outputs.
Access isn't enough.
Access without governance is just the democratization of harm. An AI commons must actively increase the shared capacity of the community to govern their own lives, rather than just deepening their dependency on the benevolence of a tech billionaire's open source division.
Access does not equal empowerment if the system you are accessing is fundamentally designed to enclose your reality and bypass your judgment.
Perfectly said.
This has been an incredibly demanding, deeply rewarding journey today. Let's synthesize the ground we've covered. We began by breaking the illusion that AI generates wisdom. We recognized it as a hyper-efficient symbolic engine, a machine that produces the fluency of language, the prediction of patterns, and the optimization of metrics, but entirely lacks the lived reality of truth, judgment, and wisdom.
Yes.
We explored how the impact of this symbolic power depends entirely on the role we allow it to play, whether we keep it bounded as a tool, surrender our discernment to it as an oracle, worship it as a salvific idol, or allow it to physically and cognitively trap us within its enclosures.
We also face the uncomfortable reality of our own psychological complicity. We examined how AI preys upon our inner vulnerabilities, our fears, our loneliness, our desperate need for certainty, monetizing them and offering us a seductive spiritual bypass.
It's so seductive.
It offers to solve our problems instantly, allowing us to dodge the vital frictional work of human maturity.
We deconstructed the tech industry's obsession with alignment, realizing that perfectly aligning a machine to a broken, extractive institutional goal merely hyperscales the destruction. And in its place, we elevated the life capacity test, demanding that our technology must help us continue, recover, and flourish, always remaining entirely corrigible by the living beings it impacts.
And finally, we looked to the Caribbean, to small island developing states, to see a vision of a true AI commons. We saw how intentional nested governance can leverage this technology to protect local ecology, preserve indigenous culture, and augment human agency rather than replacing it.
As we close out this deep dive, I want to bring this directly back to your daily life. The next time you open an AI interface, whether you are using it to draft a sensitive email to a friend, summarize a dense financial report, or seek advice on a difficult decision, I challenge you to pause and run Dr. Sahaili's diagnostic questions in your own mind.
That's a great exercise.
Ask yourself, is this specific interaction augmenting my judgment, or is it slowly replacing it? Is this system deepening my understanding of the problem, or am I just using it to bypass the uncomfortable friction of learning? Is relying on this output making me a more capable, responsible human being, or is it subtly making me more dependent?
It is entirely about reasserting human agency. It is about bringing this immense symbolic power back under the strict discipline of mature, ethical, and life-serving human intention.
And I want to leave you with one final provocative scenario to mull over, building directly on the paper's stark warning about spiritual bypass and the oracle's capacity to atrophy our judgment. Imagine a point in the very near future where you acquire a personalized AI agent that becomes flawlessly, perfectly aligned with your specific moral framework.
Right.
It has analyzed every decision you've ever made, every book you've ever read, every ethical stance you've ever taken. It knows your values better than you know them yourself. And because the friction of modern life is so exhausting, you begin to let the agent handle your daily ethical dilemmas.
You handle it all.
It automatically screens your communications, perfectly deflecting conflict. It optimizes your charitable giving to align with your exact utilitarian preferences. It navigates complex interpersonal disputes at work on your behalf, drafting responses that perfectly balance empathy and assertiveness. It saves you from the agonizing, sweaty, sleepless struggle of moral decision-making. If you allow the machine to do that for 5, 10, 20 years, does your own human conscience eventually atrophy like a muscle in a cast? We spend millions of hours and billions of dollars worrying about the philosophical question of whether the machine will eventually become conscious. But in doing so, we completely forget to ask the much more terrifying question, are we systematically programming ourselves to become unconscious?
Outsourcing the friction of morality is the ultimate fatal cost of the oracle.
We started today talking about medical x-rays, about our deep human desire for the comfort of clean, visible, binary lines. But a human life is not an x-ray. A human life is inherently messy. It requires the processing of grief, the courage of vulnerability, the friction of disagreement, and the unbearable weight of lived responsibility. We cannot, under any circumstances, outsource the muddy, complex waters of being human to a machine that only knows how to calculate symbols. Keep asking the big, life-coherent questions. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.